Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Jack Lepiarz. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the Center for the Study of Europe in the Pardee School of Global Studies, titled Addressing the Recognition Gap, Destigmatization Strategies, and the Production of Inequality. Our speaker is Michelle Lamotte, Robert I. Goldman Professor of European Studies and Professor of Sociology and of African and African-American Studies at Harvard University. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, Boston University Professor of Political Science, Kathy Jo Martin.
It is my very great honor, both personal and professional, to introduce my dear friend and esteemed colleague, Michelle Lamotte. So Michelle is the Robert L. Goodman Professor of European Studies, with appointments in the Harvard Sociology Department and the Department of African and African American Studies. She's also the director of the Harvard Weatherhead Institute for International Affairs. She's the beneficiary of many prizes and awards, way too many to mention here. She's received fellowships from the Guggenheim Foundation, the Radcliffe Institute, the Russell Sage Foundation, and the Institute for Advanced Study, among others. Michelle's the author of several extremely important books, and I'll just name three: The Dignity of Working Men, Morality and the Boundaries of Race, Class, and Immigration; How Professors Think, which is really quite fascinating, not only for personal reasons, but for professional ones. And she's going to talk with us today about her most recent book, Getting Respect, Responding to Stigma and Discrimination in the United States, Brazil, and Israel. So without further ado, let me present Michelle Lamotte. Thank you so much.
It's a real pleasure to be here. I thank my friend Kathy for this very nice introduction. It's a real pleasure, really, you know. So the objective of the talk is really to put down some tools to develop an empirical sociology of recognition and stigmatization. And in order to do this, we need concepts, we need measures, we need description of whether there is a recognition gap, how does it look like, and we also need to define pathways forward for the analysis, define a research agenda. So this is what I'm going to do now. And this is how the talk is going to move forward. I'm going to provide concepts that will help frame the discussion. I will discuss this growing recognition gap and changes in the boundaries toward poor immigrants and Muslim that have occurred under the influence of neoliberalism. Then I will discuss the recognition gap as a dimension of collective well-being and explain how institutions and cultural repertoire can be used to extend cultural membership to a broader range of people. For those of you who don't understand at all what I just said, think about same-sex marriage laws, which brought about a huge decline in the number of attempted suicide among high school students, simply because it sent them the message, you belong. So that's an example of how institutions contain messages about who's in and who's out, and how it influences the experience of a stigmatized group. Then I'm going to turn to the book Getting Respect, which Kathy mentioned, which is about how members of stigmatized groups, African-American, Black Brazilians, and three groups in Israel, Ethiopian Jews, so we have Black people in three national contexts, but also Arab-Palestinians and Mizrahim, who are Oriental Jews, who are stigmatized in relation to Ashkenazi, the European Jews, how they experience stigmatization and how they go about responding to it. And we find very different pattern. African Americans confront much more than any of the other group. So you're going to understand how these things vary. And finally, if I have time, I'll talk a little bit about studying destigmatization processes, building on an article that I co-authored with the two graduate students where we compared the destigmatization process of people with HIV/AIDS, African Americans, and the obese. Well, the obese is the group that is not being destigmatized in any way. Fat people are stigmatized all the time. But HIV/AIDS is a stigma that has changed drastically over the last 30 years. It's a great success story of destigmatization. So we studied exactly how this happens and to try to understand it as a social process, as something that happened out there in a three-dimensional space, not something that's happening between our ears, which is very important because one of the big trends now when organizations are trying to deal with stigmatization is that they use something called the implicit association test, which measures how often on the computer people associate white, black, good, bad, and it measures the speed of the association. And the Chicago police, for instance, is now using this test, asking policemen to take the test regularly to make them aware that they're racist. Well, it's nice, but except that you have to take the test every few weeks to remember it. And the idea is about making people aware that even good people are racist, it's supposed to change reality. Well, I think it's much better to think about how to activate the destigmatization of groups as opposed to activate how people react to the groups. Okay. So really what I'm trying here is to address the question of how can we extend cultural membership to the largest possible number, and I'm approaching that question through three different angles by focusing on institution and cultural repertoire, on how members of stigmatized groups respond, and also how what are the social processes by which a group can be destigmatized. So I'm going to define a few concepts. Those of you who are not sociologists in the room, you will find this painful, but it's good for you, I promise. So whereas distribution is about material resources, Axel Honneth defines recognition as a social act by which the positive social worth of an individual or a group is affirmed or acknowledged by others. So here I approach recognition not as an act, but as a cultural process. So what's the difference? Cultural processes are things that are ongoing in everyday life. They occur all the time. They involve the intersubjective definition of reality between people, and they have consequences for the distribution of resources. So it's a, you know, everyday accomplishment in the context of everyday life. Stigmatization, which is can be viewed as the mirror opposite of recognition, can be understood following Irving Goffman, a very important interactionist, as a process that consists in qualifying negatively identities and differences. So concomitantly, destigmatization is a social process by which low-status groups and individuals gain recognition or cultural membership. And cultural membership, finally, is the status characteristics of those who are collectively defined as valued members of a society. So there's a huge literature that is concerned with giving voice to stigmatized groups. So the work of Du Bois, of Fanon, there's a huge literature in critical race theory, in indigenous, disability, gender, and LGBTQ studies. That literature on giving voice is very important, but it's not what I'm doing. As a sociologist, I'm studying this as a social process. I'm trying to document empirically how it's working so that we can really make sense of it better. I try to clarify and further expand our understanding of how this works. So I will often refer to the concept of cultural repertoire, and this is a little bit heavy going, but it's important. The notion of cultural repertoire refers to the cultural tools that are unevenly available across social context. So they are used by people to make sense of the world. So the notion of, let's say, American dream exists out there, and we're constantly mobilizing it to make sense of our lives. The dreamers, for instance, use it. But I'll give you an example of how this works. A culture of working class solidarity is far more available in France than in the US. And this is not because the French are naturally more solidaristic, but because you have historical cultural repertoires such as republicanism, socialism, Catholicism, which makes this notion of solidarity far more salient in the environment of the French working class than the American working class. So in its focus on the tools that are available where, comparative cultural sociology has allowed social scientists to move away from what we call methodological nationalism. That is this approach that says the French are like this, the American are like that, which had been criticized for being very essentialist. It's like saying the Jews are like that, the black people are like that. Social sciences as a whole has moved away from this over the last 40 years. So the question then was, how can you continue to talk about cultural differences? Well, by focusing on, you know, the tools that are available in our environment, it allows us to do this in a way that is not stigmatizing and not essentialist. So we can also talk, for instance, about the culture of the poor without falling into the culture of poverty conservatism. So let's turn to this question of neoliberalism and the growing recognition gap. So for the last 40 years, we've seen the ascent of neoliberalism, which neoliberalism can be defined as a set of mutually reinforcing changes which extend to the market mechanisms and market fundamentalism to all aspects of society. So to the economy, to the state, to what we call the audit society, the fact that the performance is constantly measured in many, many ways, the fact that we're using these watches to measure our body, it's part of the same phenomenon. But it has also had a huge impact on the scripts that we use to define a worthy self. So the criteria of worth that we associate with it. So what's defined the scripts of neoliberalism? It's a context in which socioeconomic achievement has been the measure by which people assess their worth and that of others. Whether you are a phony, an asshole, pardon my friend, doesn't matter anymore. What counts is that you are successful, you're competitive, you make money, and also self-reliance, or what sociologists have called the privatization of risk, has become very important. And it has led to a growing recognition gap and a transformation of group boundaries. So this is evident whether we look at trends in the last decades in France, Europe, and also in the United States. So let's talk about France and the United States for a minute. In both countries, white working class men have experienced a growing recognition gap at many levels. For instance, they've experienced a lot of economic downward mobility, de-skilling, the declining prestige of their national identity, for instance, Americanness, which was really a source of pride for the American working class, has lost some of its status. And you've also had changes in gender roles that have really hurt the working class because these men thought of their superior status as protectors and providers as a real sense of source of self-worth. But this decline has generated a lot of anger and resentment. The books by Arlie Hochschild, Catherine Kramer have, you know, discussed this at length. So it happens that I wrote a book that came out in 2000 titled The Dignity of Working Man, for which I did interviews in the early 80s. And I studied these very same men who voted for Trump in the last election. And in this book, I argue in one of the chapters that these men, above all, define themselves as people who try to keep the world in moral order. And they do this in part by drawing strong boundaries toward the poor and toward African Americans. So they perceive themselves as the people who pay their bills, who keep their kids out of prison, who have a strong work ethic. And then at the same time, as they say to me in these interviews I conducted, there was over 150 of them, I'm the kind of person who's a survivor, who keep going no matter what. I'm not like these guys who live off welfare, who are too lazy to be self-reliant, who are sponges. So you see right away strong boundaries toward the poor, and especially not these black people who like to sponge off people like me. So a lot of this, you know, very seamless connection between their self-definition of their moral worth and very strong racial and class boundaries. But these themes of privatization of and self-reliance becomes even more salient, so these boundaries are partially strong. At the time I did the interviews in the early 90s, and these interviews were conducted in northern New Jersey, they were rarely mentioning immigrants. The immigrants were largely absent from their narrative, or they were indifferent toward them, perceiving them as people who moved here to embrace the American dream. In France, in contrast, they were far more inclusive of the poor. They said the poor, you know, we have to take care of the poor, you know, using kind of Catholic, socialist, republicanist ideology. They were also much more inclusive toward the blacks, black people, which they perceived, which were at the time mostly French citizens from the Caribbean, than American workers were. And they also, but on the other hand, the French workers drew very strong boundaries toward North African immigrants and Muslims, who they perceived to be fundamentally incompatible with French values, particularly human rights. And they also perceived them as getting a larger share of the resources from the state than they deserved. So the issue of the pecking order was absolutely crucial to them. And they also presumed that these Muslims totally lacked self-reliance. So in a recent paper, with a French collaborator, we looked at how these boundaries changed between when I did these interviews And today, using the secondary literature, we found a lot of changes. We found that boundaries toward blacks, which were quite weak and porous in 93, are now much stronger, in part because this group now includes many West African Muslims. So the boundaries toward Muslims and the boundaries toward blacks are converging. And the group is blamed for their fate far more than they were in earlier decades. Boundaries toward Muslims have also worsened a lot. There's a category called les petits moyens, or the lower middle class, and they are the aspiring to be upwardly mobile and are now far less generous toward the poor than they were 25 years ago. And these are the very people who embrace the values of neoliberalism, such as the privatization of risk, who are asking the poor to be more self-sufficient, who want to kick the immigrants out, and who support the Front National. Now, interestingly enough, when I did the interviews in 93, the youth was never mentioned. Now it's extremely salient also because you have a very high unemployment rate among the youth in France. Now, in another small paper, we compared the boundaries of France to other European countries, and we found that in Western Europe, you had boundaries toward Muslims that were becoming far more salient over time, while the boundaries toward the poor declined a bit, with very different patterns in Eastern Europe. Now, when it comes to the United States, we know that the American working class has experienced changes that are not at all unlike those that the French have experienced. So surveys show that Americans today have less solidarity toward the poor and are more likely to explain poverty by moral failure than by structural change. And this trend has really accentuated over the last 20 years. And that's even true among African Americans, who had been historically far more compassionate toward the poor than white people. So by some account, the boundaries toward African Americans have weakened in the US, at least if we look at attitudinal surveys about racial stereotypes. Blatant racism has declined. Of course, you have a lot of symbolic or subtle racism. You have patterns of spatial and institutional segregation that persist. We know, for instance, that school segregation has been in many ways increasing in some regions. So you have kind of a mixed picture, but at the same time, and most importantly, boundaries toward immigrants, and of course particularly illegal immigrants, have enormously rigidified in the post 9/11 context, and also now, especially since the last election. So as I mentioned earlier, Trump's electoral speeches really capitalize on these very changes and accentuate the boundaries toward immigrants, refugees, and Muslims. Of course, that's not every group. Asians are not stigmatized to the same extent. So the growing recognition gap may be viewed as a reaction to the institutional diffusion of a culture of diversity over the last decade. So this diffusion is obvious in higher education, in corporation. Many corporations now have human resource departments that are charged with maximizing diversity in the law. So I can give you half a dozen sociology books that demonstrate the spread of this culture of diversity over the last 20 years. It has been symbolized by the election of Obama as the first American black president, the election of Sadiq Khan as the first non-white and Muslim mayor of London. And we have also had the post-millennial wave of social protests led by groups that have suffered from stigmatization, such as Black Lives Matter. You know, same-sex marriage has also been viewed as a watershed moment. So everyone thought we were like on a linear path of progress, and then the Trump election came, and then people thought, oh, wait a minute, this is not linear progress. It's maybe cyclical, maybe it's over. So this... you know, although this movement is not, you know, stable, or the point here is really that neoliberalism is having an impact on definition of cultural membership across societies. The rigidification of boundaries toward the poor is clear, and with much more emphasis put on self-reliance, competitiveness, and socioeconomic success. And your generation students here, you've been very much the victim of this because you have encountered really extremely competitive conditions when it came to college application, and you've had helicopter mothers, and you've had a lot of anxiety, facing a lot of anxiety about your future, which is exactly an example of what these scripts of neoliberalism do to people. Like, if I don't find a good job, I'm nothing, you know? So So the point is really that you have a narrowing of definition of cultural membership. And, you know, in Israel, for instance, people who are unemployed, there's a wonderful book by a guy named Ofer Sharon that says they interpret unemployment totally differently than it is the case in the U.S. They say, oh, the market is irrational. There will always be some people who are unemployed. Well, this year it's my turn, but I'm still a good and worthy person. Whereas here, it's very, very difficult for the unemployed to make sense of their situation in a way that allows them to still feel proud of themselves. So this is a book that is worth reading. It's called Flawed System, Flawed Selves. So now I'm going to turn to the next point, which is about resources and cultural repertoires and institutions. So we have a number of different disciplines that have used measures of various dimensions of collective well-being. So we have, for instance, the demographers and the public health people who focus on factors such as low infant mortality and high life expectancy. The societies that do better on these two measures are presumed to be the best societies. You have economic measures such as the Gini index. You have political measures such as corruption. And since 2002, I've been involved in a research project called Successful Society, and we have been focusing on cultural membership as a dimension of collective well-being. So one of the members of the group, Will Kimlicka, who's a leading scholar of multiculturalism, has developed something called the Multicultural Index. And this index measures how many policies various societies have adopted to facilitate the life of immigrants by, for instance, offering integration courses, English as a second language, a number of measures. And they show that societies that rank the highest on this multicultural index are also societies that have immigrants that are most engaged emotionally and cognitively with the host society and that are most likely to want to run for office. So basically, if you put in place the policies that tell people you're in, you belong, people react by behaving in such a way that they want to be more engaged. So this research in particular, I think, is a great example of how resources is a way to promote cultural membership. And so certainly DACA is a way to destroy it, right? So the law I mentioned earlier, protecting same-sex marriage and access to public funds in the form of tax credit, for instance, sends very clear signal about who's in and who's out. And the same thing is true about the cultural repertoire, which impact group boundaries. As discourses of solidarity that weaken boundaries toward the poor, immigrants, or black people. So promoting a wide range of criteria that broaden cultural membership so that socioeconomic success is not so predominant that those who are not rich perceive themselves and are perceived by others as losers. So one thing we can do as a society is very explicitly tackle this question of having a plurality of criteria by which people can be judged as worthy, whether they are businessmen or spiritual people or pillars of the community. But that's a tall order. So now I'm going to turn to the book Getting Respect, which was co-authored by seven people. Five of us consider ourselves members of stigmatized group. You have here several Jewish people. You have an African-American. You have a Quebecois. You have a Mizrahi. So what we did is really look at, we compare how ordinary people who are not involved in social movement experience inclusion and how they go about claiming cultural membership. So we did interviews with over 400 people living in and around Rio de Janeiro, New York City, and Tel Aviv, and everywhere. We chose people randomly. I'm going to spare you the detail of the research design, but we ask everyone, can you describe to me an incident where you feel you were treated unfairly? Describe to me what happened and how did you respond? And then we had a series of questions that had to do with what do you teach your kids about how to deal with racism? Or also, what are the best tools that your group has at its disposal to deal with racism? And then we used this computer-based software, you know, for analyzing data, and we analyzed the heck out of it. So we came up, for instance, in the U.S. with over 700 incidents that were described by our respondents, and we analyzed very quickly, closely what kind of incidents they talked about, where did the thing happen, how did they respond. So we were able to identify patterns. So I'm going to give you an example of these incidents we talked about. So it's the case of an African-American who finds himself alone with several white men in an elevator, and he describes the interaction that follows. He says, "One of them made a joke about blacks and monkeys. I said, 'Man, I ain't into jokes.' His demeanor changed, my demeanor changed. All the positive energy that was in there was being sucked out because of the racial part. I told myself, 'Get out of here, because if I stay here, I'm going to be in that circle and I won't be able to get out.' The stress level rose, my tolerance was getting thin, my blood pressure peaking and my temper rising. By the grace of God, thank you, Jesus, as I stepped off the elevator, there was a black minister walking past. I said, 'Can I speak to you for a minute? Because I just encountered something that I got to talk about because I'm this far from exploding. I'd been at my job for only a week. This is all I need to get me fired. Now I'm just trying to get through this affair to decide if I should go to the city to complain.'" So in this example, you have the description of the incident, and then you have the guy reflecting on what he should do. He said, "I had to calm down first. Luckily, this black pastor gave me huge relief because at least he could relate. Now I'm in the process of deciding what to do." So what we do then is, you know, take that kind of data and code it, and we came up, the analysis is very inductive, right? Which means that we use people's words and then we classify, we create categories among our respondents. So these are the groups we studied, but I'm not going to be able to talk to you about Ethiopian Jews and Mizrahim. It would be too much. But I'm going to tell you some of the differences that we found. And, you know, the reason we chose those three countries is Brazil is well known for its very high rate of interracial marriage, low spatial segregation. Israel is a place of hyper-segregation, and, you know, we were curious about where the U.S. was going to fall. So there are theoretical reasons behind our choice. So what patterns did you find? Here I'm going to summarize 200 pages of analysis in 5 minutes. So basically, the main kind of experience that people talk about in the three sites is what we came to call assault on worth. It's the fact of being ignored, underestimated, overlooked, misunderstood. So the teacher who walks in every morning in the teacher's room and no one says hi to her. So these are not things you can sue about. The vast majority of the literature on racism in the U.S. is about things you can sue, you know, housing segregation, discrimination, health discrimination, employment discrimination, educational discrimination. The things that we're talking about are often described as microaggression. We don't use the word aggression because being ignored is not necessarily a direct aggression. A lot of what they describe are things that did not happen. But they are extremely hurt by it, and it's extremely meaningful to them. So it's very important that we study it, even if the aggressors, the stigmatizers, don't agree that stigmatization is happening. We believe that stigmatization, if a person experiences stigmatization, it is stigmatization. It does not require confirmation from the dominant party. So these assault on work are mentioned far more frequently than discrimination. And that's true across all sites. Now, there are differences across sites. One of them is black Brazilians are much more likely to say that they are being stigmatized as poor, twice more often. 50% of Brazilians say that when they describe an incident where these people are middle class and they're very upset because people think they're poor. A quarter of Americans do this. So they are much less certain when they experience racism or classism than their American counterpart. They will denounce racism only if race is explicitly named. Otherwise, they will risk being viewed as racist, and they don't want that. So the analysis, I will explain these differences in a second. For Arab Palestinians, the pattern is quite different. They are distrusted as the enemy within because they are presumed to be solidary toward the Palestinian cause, and they face extremely blatant and violent insults, such as, "You dirty Arab." There's no ambiguity at all about the social exclusion they experience, and they never complain about being misunderstood because they have no hope of being understood. It simply would make no sense in their context. When it comes to response, as the project was started, we had in mind a classic book by Albert Hirschman, Exit, Voice, and Loyalty. After we did our inductive analysis, we came up with these categories. So Alex, confronting is by far the response that is most present in the U.S., used by over 80% of our respondent. And in this case, it's often using the law, using unions, using HR department. And it is the people say you have no choice, you have to confront, you have to speak up. So it's almost like a mantra. So 4 out of 5 of our respondents say that you have to confront, which is in the U.S., compared to half in Brazil and still fewer among Arab Palestinians. So I'll give you an example. Megan, she's a teacher, and she describes how she deals with white people who cut in front of her at the grocery store, the Pathmark. She says, these are white people who do that all the time. They just think they're trying to be superior. So she explained how she recently told off a white woman when she said to her, confronting her in the line, you do this to me not because I'm black, but because you're white, because my being black has nothing to do with you. She reflects, and of course, it comes to a shock to them that I would say that. They don't want confrontation. If you confront them, they're not going to give you a word back because you just are not there. You don't exist for them. So I don't think that this woman is going to do this to many more black women. One woman, actually, I just put off my foot and tripped her. So you can really see the anger there, right? So the second most popular response among African Americans is what we came to call management of the self, building on Goffman. So here, respondents think about the practical implication of their response and impression management. Like, this is quite different from not responding. Like, one of them said, oh, I didn't respond, I was just too hungry, I wanted to eat, I don't want to start a fight in the restaurant, or I was so surprised I didn't see anything. In the case of management of self, they spend a lot of time mulling things over and talking to their friends. Look at what happened to me, do you agree that this was racist or not? So one woman explained not wanting to, quote, be viewed as the angry black bitch again, but I want to be viewed as the successful lawyer that I am, as someone who's going somewhere. Therefore, when something happens to her, she just spends a lot of time mulling things over, and this is a huge expense of energy that white people never have to face, and that leads to this chronic stress associated with racial disparity in health. So we were very surprised that very few Americans say that they respond to incidents by displaying competence and work, because that's the neoliberal response by excellence. That's when they describe incidents to us. But when they describe normative response, what they teach their children, in this case, this thing about work hard, be competitive, be upwardly mobile, was extremely salient. So it's an interesting tension. And when we did the analysis of the data around 2012, 2013, shortly after, Black Lives Matter explodes. So we were very confused about, you know, the overall absence of collective orientation in their response, that individualistic response. Only 20% proposed a collective response. And we know this because we coded all mentions of education to see how many of them thought, you know, education lifts all boats. It's a way, you know, to lift a race versus my education is my way for me to be upwardly mobile and consume. And by far, it was a much more individualistic response. So we felt like, whoa, the 60s are gone. You know, the legacy of the civil rights era is gone. I remember very well thinking that when we were coding the data. And then, you know, a few years later, you have the explosion of Black Lives Matter, which mostly mobilized college students, or at least that, I think it was largely a movement of a collective definition of reality. So anyway, that's another story. In Brazil, you have very different patterns. Confrontation, no response, and management of the self are equally salient in Brazil. And Black Brazilians experience far more uncertainty, as I said earlier, in labeling an incident as racist. And finally, Arab Palestinians are much more likely to ignore, as they have very little hope to change anything. So a crazy thing that this book does is that we come up with a complex explanation for these findings. And the explanation draws on 3 sets of factors. The first set of factors is kind of standard set of background factors in structural analysis. So they have to do with the extent to which the societies are unequal, much more inequality in Brazil than in Israel or the U.S., how racially segregated is the society, how much, you know, how often people encounter people of different racial groups. But it also includes state capacity. So, for instance, in Brazil, you have laws, but they are not, you don't have as many regulatory mechanisms to make them work as in the U.S. And the legal landscape, of course, it varies across the three societies. Then you have cultural repertoire, which I defined already, the scripts that people can draw on. So here we talk about, you know, the national myths, the American dream, Zionism, racial democracy, which push people in very different direction when it comes to responding. But you also have transnational repertoire, such as neoliberalism and human rights, which are present everywhere. And then you have huge differences in the scripts about groups. So the extent to which there's a shared understanding of, for instance, are black people, are white people domineering? Can they be trusted? This shared scripts, institutionalized scripts about the symbolic boundaries between groups vary enormously between countries, being much, much weaker in Brazil than they are in the U.S. And the last variable, we use this concept, not variable, but dimension of explanation, is this concept of groupness, which has become very important in the literature and ethnicity in the last few years. But what we do is we operationalize it in a way that captures what's happening between the two ears, so in-group, out-group, what psychologists have spent a lot of time studying. So at the level of the identity, but we think of groupness as having to do not only with self-identification, but also with the patterns of boundaries in which people live. So frequency of interaction with out-group members through networks, through intermarriage, and the symbolic boundaries are these scripts, institutionalized scripts about the other groups that I just mentioned. So in our analysis, we find important differences in how strongly bounded these groups are. So basically, we argue that of our five groups, you have two very strongly bounded groups, African-Americans and Arab-Palestinians, and three very weakly bounded groups, Black Brazilians, Mizrahi Jews, and Ethiopian Jews. So many Mizrahi Jews engage in what my collaborators call participatory destigmatization, to say, yeah, we're at the bottom of the labor market, but we're Jewish. So therefore, we're going to be integrated in society. It doesn't make any difference. So the question then for us is, what are the conditions that enable this response? So in the book, we argue that in the cultural repertoires of racial mixture, which is prevalent in Brazil, it emphasizes the idea that we all have a grandmother, a black grandmother somewhere. So people in the same family may have very different phenotype. And this really works against the polarization between groups and it lowers the likelihood that people will confront racism. It lowers the salience of racial polarization and it also contributes to the greater visibility of class discrimination. So these factors enable the fact that she does not confront, just as is the weak boundedness of the Black Brazilian experience. So they think of their identity as anchored in shared skin color, not shared culture or shared history. So this means that the cultural schemas about racism, which are so omnipresent in the U.S., are far less so in Brazil. And all these factors contributing to making this woman more hesitant to confront the hotel clerk. So not having immediately access to these scripts of tools or tools that would enable one to make sense of the situation as a direct impact on the response. So in contrast, why are African Americans such as Megan much less hesitant to define an incident as racist or to confront than their Brazilian counterpart? So we argue that Megan's confidence is enabled by these ready-made scripts about racist interaction between blacks and white, which are sustained by an awareness of racial exclusion, inequality, and knowledge of inequality in history, in which confirms to Megan that she's actually witnessing a racist behavior. But you also have, importantly, a legal culture which is backed by the Civil Rights Act, which convinces her that it is entirely legitimate to stand up for oneself when facing racial slight. So her strong sense of groupness, which makes her race salient and convinces her that being cut in line has to do with racism, feeds her confidence to respond this way. So again, in Brazil, in contrast, confronting is done in a much more low-key way, if they do it at all, with an orientation toward educating the non-black. There's a strong notion of conviviality, racial conviviality, that is really condemns strong confrontation. So in contrast with African Americans, very few Arab interviewees use legal tools to respond. Even in the most egregious cases of housing discrimination, they do not seek legal redress. Why? They do not trust the Israeli state institution in any way. They do have to manage the self at security points, checkpoints, just as African Americans do when interacting with the police. Talking back is just not a good idea. And they learn to remain silent in front of incidents that may escalate. So in a quarter of the incidents that Arab-Palestinian mentioned, they say that they remain silent or ignore the incident as a way to express their emotional detachment in a situation that many view as hopeless. So it's a form of resignation, but it is also a way to protect their self-worth and to put themselves above the aggressor. So as a postal worker states, the best way to stick it to someone is to actually ignore them. So in their context, self-isolation is a response that makes sense. It's a context of high residential segregation where confrontation is unlikely to yield results. So unlike Brazilians, these Arab-Palestinians rarely have doubts about whether an incident occurred or not. Alternative explanations are limited by the high level of groupness they experience, which is bolstered by widely available institutionalized repertoires of group disadvantage, intergroup conflicts, and exclusions. But this does not mean that they confront, like Americans do, given the constraints that they face. In other words, you have those two highly bounded groups, African Americans and Arab Palestinians, but they respond totally differently when it comes to confrontation. So to conclude, to understand patterns of experience and response among ordinary people, members of stigmatized groups, one has to consider a configuration of factors that enable and constrain different types of micro-experiences and responses that are made possible through meso-factors such as groupness and the cultural repertoire people have access to. So we construct a causal chain here to understand how groups respond to stigmatization to gain cultural membership. Now I know that I've been talking for a long time. I'll go really fast on the last part so we have time to talk. Talking briefly about destigmatization processes. So as I said earlier, we consider these three groups, people living with HIV/AIDS, African-American, and the obese. We did an extensive review of the literature on attempts to destigmatize these groups over the last decades. And we kind of do engage in process tracing. That's where we're influenced by the literature in political science, who did what where. So we have on one axis here the various types of experts who were central in making arguments for the destigmatization of these groups. Social science and media experts and journalists, social movement activists. And we find quite different patterns about who does what where. And then in this article, which came out in Social Science and Medicine last September, we create this kind of causal chain where we connect the existing ideologies on which they draw, the kind of social actors that were mobilized, what kind of actions they engaged in to destigmatize the groups. And finally, we ask ourselves what worked. And what were the outcomes? So the literature on stigma says that one of the main, you know, things that has to happen in order for a group to be stigmatized is you have to destigmatize, is you have to remove blame. You have to show that anyone can get it. So it's not only gay people who are promiscuous who get AIDS. You can get AIDS through other methods. So this leads to the destigmatization. So you have, and this is empowered in part by the status of the actors who are involved in the destigmatization process. So the article discuss in particular the case of Magic Johnson, who as a sport hero comes out as having AIDS, and which really helps, transform the perception that people have of this disease. So the takeaway of this paper is really that we have to broaden the causal chain beyond the implicit association test, this test I discussed at the beginning, which is administered to everyone under the earth, Harvard professors too. Everyone at Harvard takes that test to show us when you are working in the search that, you know, to make you aware of what are your biases. So we want to go beyond this cognitive approach to really consider what is the broader process of destigmatization. So the takeaway from this part of the paper, which I'm sorry I went so quickly, is really that destigmatization is an accomplishment, a collective accomplishment that requires the mobilization of knowledge workers who have historically worked hand in hand with social movement activists to result in major changes in public attitudes toward groups, which we can see clearly in survey data. So, in other words, this is a social process. It is produced. In other words, if we understand better the conditions through which groups are destigmatized, we can try to help activate them to result in the destigmatization of new groups. So, coming to my conclusion, this conclusion really is that these are these phenomena that we need to understand better. They have a lot in common. There's a number of processes that can be identified or resources that can be identified as sources of destigmatization. And we need to continue to do work on this to try to understand better how this works. So I propose a research agenda which would include, you know, comparing. Can we systematically compare the experience of LGBTQ people with members of racial minorities? We have to look at which response works best. Is confronting always the best? Under what conditions does groupness become counterproductive? If a group is so engaged in groupness, can it become self-enclosed and not be able to weaken the group boundaries anymore? And finally, we can discuss what is the takeaway practically, what is to be done, to quote Lenin. So we can discuss, you know, what social scientists can do, what politicians can do. I think I'm going to give you one interesting possibility for the case of a social scientist. I did interviews with the North African immigrants in France in the early 90s, and I asked them what makes people equal. I don't even think I used the word race. Maybe I did, I don't remember. But they said things like, oh, we're all equal because we spend 9 months in our mother's womb, or we all have 10 fingers, or there are good and bad people in all races, or we have all to get up in the morning to buy our bread at the baker. So, you know, I found these responses extremely enlightening in how people think about universalism, because when you look at the scholarly literature on universalism, especially as an expert of Europe and French republicanism, it's all grounded in political ideology. Well, these responses show you clearly that ordinary people who don't, in this case, they don't have a lot of education, it's based in kind of naturalistic metaphors. You know, we all spend 9 months in our mother's womb. So I think that social scientists really need to spend much more time studying empirically how people think about similarities and differences between ethno-racial groups or between religious groups, because we just don't know that much about this. This is an aspect of the literature that really needs to be expanded. Then we can ask ourselves, so this is what sociologists can do, really understand better other languages of universalism. What can politicians do? Well, here I'm going to go back to the case of same-sex marriage. So we know that social policy and social welfare programs can stigmatize, DECA, for instance. It can also signal who belongs. So in a study of 47 states, it has been shown that those states that have adopted same-sex marriage have seen a reduction of 7% in attempted suicide among public high school students between the age of 15 and 24. This really blows my mind. The number of suicide attempts among students represented as members of sexual minorities was 28.5% prior to the implementation of these laws by 32 states. The same-sex marriage laws were not passed to tell gay people, we embrace you as legitimate, you're part of us, but it most certainly was interpreted as such by gay youth, which may have resulted in this decline. So there are unintended consequences in the way that institutions signal who's in and who's out. Another intervention that I find particularly interesting, as a Canadian, when I was a teenager, Pierre Elliott Trudeau, the then prime minister, decided to pass a policy defining Canadian society as multicultural. That was in 1971. So many Quebec nationalists felt that this really marginalized their status as one of the two founding nations of Canada, and it put them in the same bag as newcomers, such as the small Ukrainian minority of East Central Alberta. People were really pissed. you know. But Trudeau's multicultural policy worked extraordinarily well in an attempt to redefine Canadian collective identity. And it extended cultural membership to a much broader range of people. So now when you survey Canadians about what distinguishes them from Americans, they will say multiculturalism. So this is an extreme, a very good example of successful cultural engineering to broaden cultural membership. Now we can also ask ourselves, what can citizens do? Well, there are displays of solidarity that we see everywhere. So you have probably seen these signs, which are really expressions of solidarity and mutualism, expressions of altruism that have popped out around, on storefronts and on lawns since the election of Trump. You have also rainbow flags on Unitarian Universalist churches, signaling welcoming LGBTQ people. So these kind of, you know, public messaging really contribute to defining the collectivity in very significant ways. And I like really this slide of African, boat people landing on the beaches of Cordoba. And you have the people in bikinis there looking at them. And really the question is, how are they going to, you know, you and I, we are the people in bikinis, and we witness these, you know, refugees, and we can ask ourselves, you know, where is solidarity going to manifest itself or not? So I think whether we consider what has happened in the U.S. since November 8, it's more important than ever that we think very seriously how people interpret reality. And I think the social sciences have a crucial role in providing, and this is a lot of what we do, we provide citizens the categories through which they understand the world. You think of the notion of unemployment, it wouldn't exist if it was not for the social sciences. A lot of the research we do trickles through the media and help define how, what kind of society we want to live in, how much individualism, how much solidarity, who's in and who's out. So I think it's high time for social scientists to take on the challenge of tackling this recognition gap by really studying much more systematically what sustains it, how it is produced, what we can do to weaken it. So thank you very much for your attention. Thank you.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You just heard a lecture by Harvard University professor Michelle Lamont. Professor Lamont's lecture was titled Addressing the Recognition Gap, Destigmatization Strategies, and the Production of Inequality, and was presented by the Center for the Study of Europe in the Pardee School of Global Studies. Tonight's moderator was Boston University Professor of Political Science, Kathy Jo Martin. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You can also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Ian McCard and Edward T. Mazulis. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydovis. I'm Jack Lepiarz. Thanks for joining us.